Hi, and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a weekly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. How are you, Will?
I'm great. How are you, Carlton?
I am marvellous. And today we're joined by a very special guest, Tom Christie, creator of Django REST Framework. And, well, you know who he is. Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Oh, pleasure.
Thanks for coming on.
There's so many things to talk about. Let's, just as a broad structure, I got to ask you about Django REST Framework and then really want to talk about ENCODE and async and the future of all that. But maybe before we get to that, so how did you learn how to code? Because you're doing some really cool, almost like bare metal programming type stuff with async. And I know you have a formal background in computer science. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So I started out the way, I guess, quite a lot of people who are my age who are in the programming industry did, which was writing games for a ZX Spectrum and doing a bit of, you know, basic programming there, and also on whatever thing, you know, the Cube Basic as well, wasn't it? That was the Windows DOS one, I think, that came with snakes and something else. Gorillas was another one. Okay, both of you.
No. Gorillas was where you threw the bananas, right? And you had to throw it up and hit the other gorilla on the building.
So it came with the source code, so you could go and have a look and then try and figure out how do I turn that into a flying triangle instead, or, yeah. Right.
I thought you were going to talk about, we had Nicholas Tullerby on talking about what's that British thing that you all did?
Oh, the BBC, the BBC Micro.
did you play around with that as well, Tom? Because in the States, we didn't have anything like that.
No, that was not a thing. But you know, it was kind of by accident, trying to figure out, well, what are you going to do once you get to leaving school age, and just ended up doing a computer science degree. And I've worked in a few different areas kind of since then. So I ended up moving into, when I'd finished my degree, I then went and did a master's in computer speech and language processing. It just seemed like an interesting area. I was really interested in artificial intelligence at the time. So I went and did that, and then worked in that area of the industry for a while. And then, like most people who were on that small master's course with me, we eventually all ended up moving out of speech recognition because it's such a
too
niche
soon
domain. Well, yes, like in terms of where the money was at.
Yeah.
It was too soon because it was right before, you know, that was all before Siri came along and, you know, big boom in all of it. But even so, I think it's always quite a difficult space to work in a way because it's only really with the mega corporations and then you have this little research team, and it's such a specialized area that you're working in. Personally, I found it quite frustrating eventually. So,
well, there is. I was just going to. I know that with current options, there's for doing audio to text. One of the few non megacorps is Speechmatics, which is, I don't think, a megacorp, but it's based in the UK. But maybe they're bigger than I think they are in terms of.
I don't follow that scene anymore. So you've,
I played around with transcribing our podcast, and it's like, yeah, it's like Google, Amazon, you know, Microsoft, and then there's like a UK one, and they had a nice drag and drop option, not, you know, configure an API to test it out, and
yeah.
Neat. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted. Please.
No, that's okay. And then ended up slightly by chance, really, but ending up working in networking. So worked with a content distribution network who were doing stuff with peer-to-peer and building caches to live inside ISPs in order to save them traffic on all the peer-to-peer stuff that was going through their networks. Did that for a while, and then eventually, at the same time as I moved to Brighton, decided, okay, I just want to have a complete change of stuff. And I would like to be able to, again, with both of those things, they were really, really kind of, they were very deep technical kind of areas. but I didn't know how to build my own website, right? Or my, you know, or just to do those sorts of things. And that freedom to be able to, okay, right, I know the basics of how to put stuff together and build stuff that I can do with, and eventually, you know, build up the skills that you can use to potentially build a company or do something like that, rather than, you know,
the back end stuff.
And when I started, when I started kind of working in the web industry, that was, you know, I guess about a year later was when I started working on REST Framework.
Right. And so did you find Django at that point?
Yes. I guess that the company that I was doing, that I was working with at the time, must have been using it. No, actually, I think they weren't. I think they were using Java. And that was massively frustrating. But yes, had found Django.
Right, so I went looking for Django, right?
To corral them into, look, we should do more of this stuff because that stuff's really painful for me.
Well, and was the natural language things, was that in Python? Because most of it is now. Was Python around when you were doing your degree?
It certainly wasn't very big on the scene, right? And I've struggled to remember at what point I switched over from Bash scripting and Perl to, Oh, wait a minute, this is really, really helpful. This is much better. I think it probably was after I'd left the speech recognition-y stuff, because I can remember like some of the more impressive things that I did when I was there were very complicated sets of Bash scripts and Perl strung together. Because for all of the, with all the stuff where you're dealing with large corpuses of audio and
tagged words,
you know, you need to do so much basic wrangling with them. You've kind of got that stuff, and then you've got your like very detailed, here's my bit of C that,
right,
you know, actually does the signal processing and pulls the waveform out into a set of different signals that we can, whatever.
Yeah, and that's still the case though, right? Because a lot of the scientific Python libraries are extensions around the underlying C implementations and stuff. So it's not necessarily changed at the implementation level, even now, today.
Possibly so.
Well, that background actually, that makes a lot of sense. I was just saying before we recorded your talk at DjangoCon Europe this year on async and future of Django was fantastic. And you did a really good job of breaking down, going a level deeper on the layers of abstraction that I think is often assumed because people work at their own level. But given that you've jumped about a whole bunch of those levels professionally, it makes sense how you would be able to wrap it up together. You sort of kept going up the abstraction layers in a way to working with web stuff. But anyways, we'll link to that talk. I think for people interested in async, your talk and Andrew's Godwin's talk, which we'll link to from DjangoCon this year, I think are the two places I point people to. So I want to dive into that stuff, but what else with your story? So you were doing web stuff, and then at some point you did Django REST Framework and then Encode, right? Should we finish the professional?
Yeah, so what's the origin? What's the DRF origin story?
So what happened was basically there's this one big motivating factor. I have no idea kind of where it came out of, but the idea was, why on earth is it that out of all these APIs that we're building, none of them are web browsable? Why on earth is it that when we're having to interact with our web APIs, we're having to do that from the command line rather than just being able to point a web browser at it? HTTP is designed with content negotiation so that you can serve different representations to different kinds of clients, so that a programmatic client could get JSON, but a web browser could request HTML instead. And I had a couple of ideas about how you would do it, because there were things that made it awkward to do. So, for instance, browsers not being able to post JSON inside one of their regular forms. I mean, this was a way back, so even where JavaScript was a bit different then as well.
But even sending non-post requests, you know, to send a put or a delete, you know, the HTTP verbs aren't available in the browser.
The HTML forms themselves don't natively support it, right? And I had a couple of ideas about, well, look, here are different ways that you could get around that. And it seemed to me such an obvious and such a beneficial idea that the web API should be web browsable that, you know, I looked into, oh, can I use one of the existing frameworks at the time to do this? And eventually went, no, I don't think so. Let's just, you know, let's build a proof of concept first and show that you can do this thing. And then it just kind of snowballed from there. You know, it was the big, like, that was kind of always the big motivation, because I thought it was such a, you know, I thought it was an important idea. I ended up wanting to pile more and more time into improving the framework so I could show people how I thought we ought to be interacting with APIs.
And the browsable API is still, like, you know, I don't know how many years later now, so 7, 8, 9 years later, perhaps. The browsable API is still really cool. You know, you fire up a new API and you go to it and it's like, oh yeah, great. And okay, at some point, you know, you get nested serializers and all the rest. It doesn't handle those. But for get up and running, it's like, oh wow, this is super. And I don't have to crack open the command line and I can play around. And I can create some models. And still, it's, you know, still an awesome thing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, I think there are nicer things that we could be doing with it. But
time and effort. No?
Yes.
Well, there's, yeah. I mean, it's a great, for, I mean, I think of a lot as the admin for Django itself, where it just works, it's fantastic, and you get it out of the box. And then if you need more, you can use Postman or something, same way as, you know, you shouldn't force your Django admin to do too much. But it just, that first time experience of, like, you can see it and it works, it's, you know, that's really, really powerful. I mean, so for example, like in my book on Django APIs, I mean, it's all using the built-in web views, and I say, you know, you can go to Postman, you can do all this other stuff, but really most of what you need, especially when you're starting out, it's just the first time I saw visually those things. Actually, I think that's the case for many people. They you know, because the command line just doesn't do it.
Yeah, well, having the immediacy and the accessibility of it.
But that's interesting, you almost worked backwards. So you started with that idea rather than saying, you know, TastyPy or Twisted or the other ones, you know, the serializers were the issue. You almost sort of started with the end goal there. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. It was TastyPy and Piston at the time.
I used TastyPy. I never used Piston.
I should have done what Jesper Noah, the author of Piston, did, which is found Bitbucket and then sell that to Atlassian for... Who knows how much?
Yeah, right.
That's why he's not on the scene anymore.
Right. He's still sitting on a desert island feet up. Yeah.
So, you know.
Wow. Well, so Django REST framework, so 3.11 is coming out. Well, will be out by the time this is released. Where it's so feature complete as is, where do you see, what do you see as the future for that project? And then we'll get into all these other projects. I can't necessarily think of what more it needs beyond polishing, but you know, you two wrote and maintain it, so
yeah. So at the moment, I would say it's just in its mature phase. Now, if there is another big jump, I think that, to me, the obvious place would be. So we have an admin-like view in there at the moment, right? But it's not great. It's not that great. And I think, like, the obvious place that you could put some improvements in would be making it so that, rather than the browsable API defaulting to look like, here's a bunch of JSON and here's some form fields, it's like, well, here's your tab for the JSON and here's your tab for... I want to see this data displayed in a table and be able to paginate through it with pagination controls and so on. So, yeah, if there's another, like, big jump to happen there, I think that's probably where I'd be most interested in putting time in.
That's kind of interesting.
I mean, there's also, you know, I guess, that's where I'd be most interested right now.
Because there's someone who uses DRF for building projects in the commercial environment, have done, you know, this is how I found it. I was building iOS apps and I needed a back end with API and a new Django, and I was playing with TastyPy, and I was like, this isn't working for me. And I found DRF, and I was like, this is working for me. For me, still in that, still thinking about that environment, it's the integration with the open API tooling, the schemas, the client generations, and all that stuff. And that can't be part of REST framework, really, but integrating with that ecosystem and making that more fully fleshed out, I think that's where the growth is over the next short-term period, at least. Because mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, as a jobbing programmer, that's what you need. You know, you need your API quickly, but you also need all these client libraries. And if you can produce decent docs and, you know, code examples and, you know, I know all that stuff.
The other area that I'm particularly interested in as well is, you know, at the moment we have if you're coming to a new project and you want to build an API, you've got two different slices of option. And one of your options is you use a completely hosted service, something like Firebase or something like that, and you build within their service. And you have to be happy to kind of live within the set of constraints that they provided and know that you're going to stay on their platform indefinitely. Or you go the other route and you work with a framework like Django or Rails. Now, I think
you have to host your own
a really
DevOps.
Nice space that's somewhere in the middle, which is, you know, what's the easiest way to get put, you know, express it like this, like what's the easiest way to get started with Django? Oh, well, start building your admin and your API out in this hosted service here. And you can put some, you know, you can start putting data in and so on, and you can start interacting with it as an API. And when you're ready, here's this big green let's go button, and you hit that and you've got your code and you're ready to start running that. So that's another area that I'm interested in working in.
So the other big project that you was around right at the beginning was MakeDocs, right? Which is incredible that it even exists, because Sphinx was the big beast in the room and you created this other thing. Here's my burning question. Was it just that you hated restructured text so much that you wanted to use Markdown, or was there another
No, it's just
motivation.
That I enjoyed working with Markdown so much. you know, and the tooling for Markdown was a lot better, you know, as well. Like, there's so many Markdown editors and...
Yeah. Still is, right?
And support for Markdown came to GitHub before support for restructured text and, you know, all these sorts of things. It's a trade-off. Obviously, like, you know, it's still all these years later, it doesn't have interlinking. Just pushed out a package that does... you know, you point it at your Python package and you can inject your doc strings into your Markdown, your prose.
So is this a wrapper around docutils?
It's a MukDocs equivalent of is it Autodoc that
right,
Sphinx
okay.
uses? It's an equivalent of Autodoc but for MukDocs.
So it'd be like creating API documentation, like
yes,
reference
it is,
documentation.
Yes, placing API documentation within your prose documentation. So that came out last month, and we're using that so far with HTTPX. I can't remember if I'm using it in any of the other projects yet.
Okay, and what's that called for our listeners? We'll put it in the show notes.
Auto MukDocs, maybe? I can't remember.
Okay, we'll find it. It's in the show notes.
I don't need to know. I'm using it now, so I've forgotten the name.
Okay.
Abstracted away.
That's really cool. So you've just said the big exciting thing as well, that you've mentioned HTTPX. So tell us what that is.
So actually, I'll start from what was the motivation, and then I'll kind of come to where it is now and what it is now. So the gap that was missing was, two things in particular. Number one, how do you know, what's the async HTTP client for Python? So, you know, with requests, you're using the thread concurrency model, and you're generally only able, well, you're only able to open as many outgoing HTTP requests as you have threads running. Whereas if you're using the asynchronous model, so, and that might be, you know, say maybe 10 or 20 concurrent requests. Whereas in the asynchronous model, the process of making a request doesn't block all of the other little async tasks that are off running concurrently alongside your other one thread of control that you're looking at right now. And you're able to serve thousands of concurrent HTTP requests. Now, the big question was, well, we've got requests at the moment, but how do we bring async functionality to requests? So I put a bunch of time into trying to look at what would be a good way of doing that. And eventually that evolved into, you know what, let's build a complete HTTP client from scratch all the way through, because we need to build one that is async capable up front and center. And also, you know, like, we're in a different landscape now than when requests started. So let's start by building an HTTP client that uses type annotations all the way through. So it's very, very precise about exactly what the API is. And another big thing that it's started to provide is HTTP2 support, right? So there's one other kind of halfway incomplete Python HTTP client that supports HTTP2. But there wasn't really anything kind of fully mature that had that in place. So the two big things were, let's look at async support and let's look at HTTP2 support. What it's evolved into is an HTTP client that is largely requests compatible. So wherever possible, the API meets up with requests.
So I can come along as a long-time request user, I can get me import HTTPX, and I can do my GET, and it will be more or less the same.
Yeah, that supports async. Right now, that means two things. So we support async IO, but we've also just added properly support for the Trio async library as well.
Can we have a little sidestep? What's the difference there?
Async IO versus Trio. What's the difference between those two?
So Trio is an alternate implementation instead of async IO.
The event loop.
The big thing is that, yes, the Trio people would bash me over the head because it doesn't use event loops or something. But and it had, essentially, it's a more thoroughly designed. It's got this really nice core tenant called structured concurrency, which doesn't just apply to Trio, but is a general idiom for that that they've kind of discovered for, look, here's a sensible way to deal with concurrency without having callbacks all over the place, without potentially leaking tasks that you forget about, having well-defined semantics for what happens when tasks are cancelled and so on. It's a really thoroughly designed alternative to async IO. It's a bit awkward because the two things are completely incompatible, but from the point of view of HTTPX, it's largely irrelevant. We've got these two tiny little backends, one for async IO and one for Trio, and we're able to support both of those, both of those different platforms. The plan is, we did have sync and async support for HTTPX. Momentarily, I've dropped out the sync support because we needed to re-engineer the way that that works. Previously, the sync code was kind of bridging onto the async code. So it would seem to the user like you're running synchronous code, but actually you've got an event loop running under the hood, an async code running underneath. And we're actually switching that round so that instead the sync version of the client will be a pure sync version of the client and the async will be a pure async one. And the folks working on, who worked on URLLib3, which is the thing that powers requests, have some really smart ideas about how to do that. So we've been working on that basis.
Right, super. And I was looking, I've followed that conversation. I was a bit like, don't drop the sync support because I just want to be able to pull in HTTPX as my replacement. But having looked at it, async.io has this nice function called run, which you can just call from a synchronous context and you can pass it your coroutine, which will be your HTTPX get, say.
Yeah.
And it will, without you having to pull up your event loop and run the event loop yourself, it'll, which is only a few lines, but it'll do all that for you. So
yeah. Well, and
it's
more
not...
importantly, the sync support is coming back.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know, when's the podcast coming out?
Well,
when do you want to come out?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, hopefully it's already back in.
So, right, yeah, by the time you listen to this, folks.
Sync and async HTTP client that additionally supports blah, 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 blah.
Right, so hang on, before we lose the thread here, you just mentioned URLLib3. Now, so one thing that I was sort of under the impression that the requests, one of the things about requests is it was built on kind of some older tech which wasn't quite as robust, and then the underlying networking layer has kind of been redone and URLLib3 is part of that. But all of that's a bit vague to me because I haven't dug into it and haven't researched it. Could you, what's going on there? Like, what's, you know, URLLib3, is that what we need to be using, and is I don't know, what's going on? How would you describe that stack? Has it been rewritten or is it?
So the URLLib3 team are also working on a new version of that, which brings synchronous and asynchronous support.
Okay,
now,
and that's the underlying
personally
work.
What I would like to do is, and I don't think is that difficult, is provide the ability for HTTPX to be used with that once that's available.
Right.
I mean, we've already implemented a slice of it as well ourselves, but that's the mature, battle-tested, battle-scarred, you know, deals with all these different edge cases that they've hit in the wild when servers
behave
in
strange
ways. So whereas we've got this kind of, that this is clean, HTTP works like this, this is what we expect version, it would be really, really beneficial to kind of have both those options on the table and be able to figure out where we're going from there.
So that's all still a work in progress, right? But that's kind of underlying level, that underlying layer is being...
House cleaned. They're working in the exact same space as us, and a whole bunch of the work that they've done. So, for example, their approach onto how do you build code that is both sync and async is what we're now tacking for in HTTPX, because it's smarter than the approach we had before. It's going to work out better for the project.
Well, I think one of the things I took away from your talk as well, Tom, for people listening who are new to this space, is that async requires rebuilding all the layers in the stack, which is sort of why, you know, why is the REST framework person working on HTTP? But it's because you sort of have to rebuild everything for
this
new async world.
That's certainly the motivation. But what I hope as well is, you know, as mature and great as requests is, I think it would be really great to have a new HTTP client that does all the same slice of stuff as it, because I'm really pleased with the work that we've done on HTTPX. Like, the design is really nice, and I think folks kind of coming to it now and digging into the code base will be able to get a handle on, oh, right, okay, I see how it's... I mean, that's kind of true for requests as well, actually. But... you know, we've kind of been stuck in this place where there's just this one entity and it's backed onto URLLib3. It would be nice for us to freshen up on all that again.
And it's stable, right? HTTPX is because it's like 0.8 now, is it?
It's stable if you pin to...
No, but what I mean is it's... stable isn't the right word. It's the word, I mean, like, it's fully functional, fully, I could put it into a project. It does everything I need. It's like, because the 0.0, what does the 0.0, what's left for a 1.0 then? Let's put it that way.
You should pin to a median release version. So you should pin to 0.8 or 0.9, you know, 0.9.x or 0.8.x. And the big thing that will still change is once we add sync support back in, then you've got to go, well, what are we calling the async client? And what are we calling the sync client? And what are we calling async requests? And what are we calling sync requests?
Right. So maybe an import changes or something like that.
Yes. You've got to namespace it and you've got to name it. But there's not actually a massive amount more technical work required to get there. And once it hits 1.0, that's when we'll have the, right, here's our formal deprecation policy. Here's what you can expect to happen once we upgrade to version 2 in a year's time or so on, all that stuff.
So I really want to ask you about Starlet.
Oh, cool.
So let's just assume, so ASGI, their async with web service gateway interface, we could talk about that, but let's assume that exists. Starlet's really interesting to me, and you've also done some work building out, you've been putting the code, like a new demo project with it, I believe, right? So this is, let me tell you what I think it is, and you can correct me. So this is, you're building out a lightweight framework using ASGI that the ideas of which could eventually roll into a larger thing like Django itself. Is that, how would you describe the motivations? Because I look at it as like, it's really educational for me, but you know, you have so many projects that sometimes I'm like, wait, what is Tom work? Like, you've got like a dozen active projects that are all cool
I've been trying to keep that more and more neatly corralled these days.
Django REST Framework, HTTPX, ASGI, Uvicorn, API Star, like...
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of three projects that I work on, right? So there's Django REST Framework, there's HTTPX, and there's the async web stack. The async web stack includes, well, we need an async server. So here's Uvicorn. That's your async web server. We need an async web framework. So here's Starlet. We need a way of interacting with async database drivers. That's at a nice level. So here's the databases package. We need an ORM eventually. I mean, so the ORM package, you know, that's kind of more on my horizon, but kind of got the basics in there. So there's that bit. And one or two other bits and pieces around the periphery there.
And then, Carlton, what's the schedule for Django 3 releases for how these things are added in, right? 3.1 is going to have, 3.0 has ASGI, 3.1 is Vue's.
Yeah, okay. So we've just released 3.0, and that can run under an ASGI web server. So Uvicorn or Daphne or the other one, I can never remember, Hypercorn. So you can embed, and what's useful about that at this stage is you can embed Django next to your dataset application or, you know, next to your Starlet application. It's not actually async views. So hopefully 3.1 will have async view capacity. And for there, you know, from the Django perspective, Tom's work is like breaking new ground and it's showing the way to go. And it's like, it's just amazing. And Tom's talk from DjangoCon Europe, where it was called Sketching Out a Django Redesign. And he spent the entire time talking about Starlet, not the entire time, but, you know, basically was talking about Starlet. But how else do you show what Django could become looking at other than showing what an async web framework looks like? And that's, you know, from the Django perspective, it's like, it's amazing that this stuff's here, that the work that Tom's doing and seeing it. And we can take some ideas and we won't be able to take it all. And because Django's got a lot of history and it's always going to be, it's Django and it's got to be backwards compatible and, you know, so it's a really exciting area and there's plenty of room for Starlet and Django to rob all the good ideas or as many ideas as we can. And we won't be able to rob them all because Django's Django and it's got a history and it needs to maintain that. But yeah, 3.1 for async views, which is something I'm really excited about.
Really nice has been being able to see how once we've got a standardized approach, ASCII, that, yep, you know, Andrew Godwin's designed, we're then able to go off and I can go off and do a whole bunch of work in this kind of completely different approach and different space. And he can go off and do, right, how do we start to bring this into Django? And they end up being complementary, right?
Yeah. So, okay, and we've mix got and this match, right?
Base, you can... Yeah, yeah. So, for example, like we've got the baseline functionality in Django 3.0 of you can be running in async right at the very bottom level. Well, what that means, I mean, I haven't dug into it in detail, but you'd be able to do some neat, you know, not stuff that you'll need to do all the time, but neat ideas like, okay, well, we have this one particular case where we want this path to always just proxy requests off to some other service. And you could add in an ASCII middleware to let you do that.
Yeah, using HTTP PEX to make the requests.
Yeah, and that's before it starts to give you opportunities. But coming back to what Will asked earlier, actually, because you kind of crystallized the answer to that in my mind. You said, well, what is Starlet? I'll describe it. What do you think? Well, actually, what Starlet is essentially how would I start to go about designing the fundamentals of something like Django if I was coming to it fresh now from where we are now in the landscape.
Exactly.
And that's not to say it's any, you know, of course it's not remotely at that level, but that's because, right, let's put these foundations here, let's put those foundations there, let's do this bit, let's do that bit. And you know, because when I, especially when I started working in the async space, you know, did things like, okay, well, I've got Uvicorn and that's built here, but my God, you know, trying to build some production service on top of that, like, what are all the other bits of work that I'd have to do to do that? It seems immense and undoable, and I don't want to have to work with these async database drivers. It's not my core expertise. I don't understand how to do that. But gradually, as we fill in more and more of the blanks, you know, you're going to start to see, you know, a more and more mature framework ecosystem there. Yeah,
yeah. And it's about providing the abstraction. So you don't want to handle ASCII send and receive handlers. You want a handler that takes a request and you send back a response, and you want the framework to do the send and receive to ASCII, and you don't want to look at that.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And yeah, the way that it's designed is it's kind of designed to be very lightweight, but without sacrificing the kinds of abstractions that you want to be working with at the framework level.
Yeah. And one thing you've talked about a lot is the importance of all this stuff, because we talk about async and it's all very, you know, but why does it matter? How important is this to Python and Django and other frameworks?
The space where it's important particularly is Python's position within the landscape, right? So two of its biggest competitors in particular would be JavaScript and Go. And both of those, when compared to the synchronous Python frameworks, are able to handle vastly higher levels of throughput. So, you know, for each server that you're running, you're able to handle a certain number of active users. Now, that doesn't, you know, for vast swathes of businesses, that doesn't always matter. But for the heavy hitters, it does. And also, you know, a lot of businesses, they're starting out and they're hoping, well, one day we want this to be, you know, and we don't want to have started out in a technology that we then find we're fighting against the current with. And the intention here is to build up the kind of framework where you've got all of the wonderful productivity benefits that working with Python brings without having to make the case of it doesn't matter that it's less, you know, able to handle vast amounts of loads than JavaScript, without having to make that argument, being able to say it's basically equivalent. And of course, yeah, it's not for Go, but the goalposts are shifted that much closer that it's not going to matter to your team.
Yeah, if you can get 95% performance, you know, that's probably good enough.
So anecdotally here in Boston, I hear there's a fair number of enterprise Java companies' stacks that, you know, they're switching over to new technologies in part because they can't hire Java developers because no one coming out of school knows Java. And so they're looking at, yeah, those three, Python, JavaScript, Go, as modern current workforce can use. And maybe because I flew back from PyCon on the plane with a whole bunch of these people saying, I was like, oh, why are you using Python? Oh, just for recruiting. So it's almost,
right,
you know, like, but, you know, of those are the three kind of modern, I need something high performing. Well, and really, yeah, people would say Go, and then JavaScript is mangled. So anyways, it's an interesting perspective. And I think it's right that if you can just check that box, like, again, in your talk, you had great, you showed a bunch of benchmarks and kind of why they're not the standard benchmarks people trot out, don't really matter, or are sort of incomplete, right? I mean, Carlton and I often talk in this podcast about how Python is not what, you know, the programming language is not going to be the thing that slows down your web stack anyway. But even if you're looking language to language, it's easy to look at one of those and think Python's slow, but it's really...
So let's talk about some other aspects of it as well, though, right? Because WebSocket support, right, for instance, that's one of the big... Now, Django has that with Django channels, but it's had to be kind of designed, you know, into an existing set. Whereas with Yvercon and Starlet, we're able to start from a starting point of, great, we want to be able to handle long-lived connections, such as WebSockets or streaming HTTP requests. Now, I know there's not necessarily loads and loads of good kind of tutorial level examples yet of, look at the interesting functionality that you can start to easily build out with using these stacks. But that's going to start to come. And I think that when it does, and when you start to be able to show, look, here's a production ready framework that you can start working with now, and look at those sorts of real time things that you can start to build with it, I think that will be interesting. And the other thing is forgetting about the async at all, but just Starlet in its own right, I think, is really interesting, because the, you know, having had 10 years of working with Django and, right, how would I approach this from scratch? Just the way that it's stripped everything right down, you know, it's easy to say. I think that people will kind of get a feel for it when they've been working with it for a bit. But it's a very, very low depth of complexity stack, right? And that's something that I can say nebulously and is difficult to difficult to quantify. But it's a, you know, I think it's a really elegant design. And I think that as the space on top of that starts to mature, that's going to kind of become apparent in the way that it allows you to kind of, you know, the framework ends up having a low maintenance cost, so you can work on new things quickly, you can adapt new things quickly. If you get things wrong, it's easy to move stuff around, versus, okay, cool, we're supporting, you know, versus Django's completely different thing, which is supporting tens of thousands of businesses, and here's all the things we're carrying along with us, and we do a fantastic job of continuing to evolve and support them, but it's also worth putting time into, great, here's this new sprinter on the scene, let's work with that for a bit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, totally. And like, Django's got 10 years of edge cases to, you know, to accommodate and to maintain.
And rightfully so.
I always say one of the reasons why it's still exciting is because we don't break stuff. So you know that it's still going to be there and reliable. So no, but you can use the new version. You can update and you can use the new features because you don't have, you know, I always argue that unless you're going to really abandon your app, don't be on the LTS, be on the latest major version and get the new feature and have fun with it. I mean, yeah, you've got to update every 9 months, but that's just like taking your car to the garage.
Well, so Hosted API is the name of the demo app that you built out. And I guess I want to mention to people listening, if they're more beginners, Jacob Kaplan-Moss, one of the Django creators, he had a PyCon talk 2017, which we'll link to, on if he were going to build Django today from scratch, what would he redo? Because I think at least when I try to explain to, like, I work in a co-working space, there's a whole bunch of people using Django who aren't developers, so they're managing developers. And when I try to describe async, I see their eyes glaze over. And I think part of it is they don't understand how the pieces, what is the stack? What is a web framework? So, you know, what is WSGI? How did all these things stack together? So, you know, I think of this as an educator. I want to write some courses on async, but I think it really has to start with, well, here's all the things you were using you didn't have to think about, but like, here's what the stack is. Here are the choices. Because I think until you can understand why async beyond real time sounds nice, you have to see where what you're dealing with, and a lot of people haven't.
See, I think the thing is, the reason that we're having to talk about the technical aspects is because it's still immature.
Yeah.
Right. And what I've been working on really hard is, you know, Hosted API is just like kind of the very, right, let me figure out what we're still missing, is until you can get to the point where you can put your technology in front of people that really don't know an awful lot about the space and say, hey, look at this cool thing. Isn't this what your business wants to be able to do or to be able to build or, you know, to have your team work with? You know, and I'm hoping to be able to get into that much more user-facing space.
Well, what do you think that example is, right? Because I think of, well, maybe it's like, what is, you know, something you build the sync way and the async way, and you can just show it's massively more performant. Is there, like, I mean, it's like, oh, chat seems a little bit faster. Like, what would be a good, you know, killer example, right? Like, what's the, like, equivalent of, like...
So a real-time admin... Right, so a real-time admin plus, and look, here's a bit of JavaScript that we've written on the other side, and here's a website where we've got these various kind of graphs that are updating, and we can see when we put, you know, either when we're putting data into the admin, we can see that stuff updating over here.
Yeah, so kind of what Hosted API is.
No, you know, maybe one day I'm skirting around, you know, bigger plans. Or here's a simpler example, right? So being able to, when you start up Django, right, and you get your little welcome screen and then you've added in the admin and you get the admin, right, what would be really nice in async framework land would be, once you've started your new project and you go to a screen, you can see like a real-time graph of how many requests per second are we running at the moment, and it's updating all the time. What's our throughput? How many servers are running and currently connected to the same channel at the moment? To be able to see really responsive set of information like that, and have those be in your basic programmer's toolbox. So, you know, rather than Django debug toolbar is the kind of level that we're looking at, you know, responsive set of information that's coming back straight away about, you know, those sorts of things.
And in the Phoenix web framework, which is in which is built on the Elixir language, which is kind of like a functional thing built on the Erlang VM, they've got a thing which is really the new hotness at the moment called Light, which they call Live View, which is exactly this kind of real-time communication back to the server, and they can do, you know, inline validation, send back the response, updates in line, and it's like Ajax, but Ajax plus 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 plus, because it's so quick and, you know, and really easy to implement, and they've kind of got that nice, and it'd be nice if Starlet had that, it'd be nice if Django can get there in its time. And you know, for me, you start, you take a beginner and you run them through and you create a Django model and they start and they spin up the admin and they do. Imagine doing that, but just with an async framework where, you know, they don't even know about its async. They're just building something and they're, and all of a sudden it's like they're programming and they're learning to program, but using this really cool modern async stack.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah. One of the things that is difficult, though, of course, is trying to balance that, you know, trying to balance Django REST framework with, okay, I think that the revitalizing the HTTP space in Python is really important. So here's HTTPX with, oh, I think that the async web space in Python is really important. So here's the async web stack. Right, trying to balance those things and trying to make the case for, you know, especially with in places where stuff is newer, trying to make the case for, yes, this is less mature. No, your business shouldn't necessarily be working on this yet, unless you know that you've got a good reason to. But yes, we think it's worth investing the time up front on.
And so we come to the final and perhaps most important topic is Encode OSS and your work to build the tagline. What's there? The tank sustainable software development, right? That's how you framed it.
Yes, yeah, it could be.
Well, perhaps it was one. Perhaps
no,
it was
oh, it is,
once
good.
Upon a time.
But collaboratively funded software development is what it is.
That's right. Okay. It. There you go. Yes, that that chimes.
Because like we've mentioned what a dozen packages, DRF, Starlet, Uvicorn, you know, HTTPX. How on earth can you do it? And you know,
well, yeah, and there's a short answer to that is, my time is fully funded. I work on this stuff full time. Actually, I think it's interesting going back into the story of how that happened to come about because it's quite lucky, really. You know, Django REST Framework 2, version 2, was when we very first ran a Kickstarter for it. And at the time, I was working with the web consultancy DabApps, and they were really on board with the idea of running a Kickstarter for this. So we kind of came to an arrangement where we said, okay, we'll do a Kickstarter and, you know, we'll figure out for however much money the Kickstarter makes, here's how much of my time can be taken out of client projects and instead just be put to working on REST framework. And we ran the Kickstarter and it was wildly successful, you know, for REST framework 2. I can't remember how long ago that was now, but
it was a way back because I got involved with REST framework before version 2, but it was like it was coming along and there was the Kickstarter and it was years ago.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the timing happened to be just right. People could see, you know, what we wanted to do. It just about started emerging as, you know, like the more mature, like for a long time, Tasty Pie had been overall the kind of the slightly better choice in terms of if you just want to look at what features have they each got, but the timing just happened to be just right. And you know, we got like £30,000 from the Kickstarter, and I worked on REST framework 2 for I can't remember, but you know, between 6 months and 9 months, somewhere in that area, which was fantastic. When we came to okay, here's a new slice of work that I think needs to happen, and REST framework 3, again, we got pretty lucky with the timing because Mozilla had just launched their grants scheme. And I knew that although I wanted to run a big kind of initial fundraiser for it, what I actually really wanted was ongoing funding rather than a single Kickstarter style drop, work, 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 now we're done. And it wasn't really obvious to me that leaving my job would be a good idea or not. But because I'd applied to the Moss grant, the way it went was once that grant, you know, once they came back and said, yep, here you go, here's your grant, which I think was about 50, I think it was $50,000. I think it was £30,000 again. So that gave me this huge chunk of runway, you know, like best part of a year. And I said, okay, like Tab Apps is a great place to work, but I can see an opportunity here. So I quit and launched the ongoing funding model. And I thought, well, we'll wait and see how many companies pitch in with this and what kind of level it gets to. And if it's 50% of what I need, then at least I'll know, you know, I'll have a year's worth of figuring out, and maybe I can go back to Dab Apps and work there, you know, half time or whatever. But as it happens, we've just about got enough to keep me going full time on things. And sometimes we've had a bit more, and sometimes Carlton's had contractor time on it. Yeah. Sometimes in the past I've supplemented it with a little bit of contracting and so on. But on the whole, I'm trying not to do any of that at all and just use the funded time. And the pitch that I always go with if I'm ever on stage talking about it is, you know, I want to work for your company full time for $100 a month. Because that's what the case is. And it's so clear then why collaboratively funded open source development makes economic sense, right?
It's like an insurance policy.
Makes business sense. Yeah.
It's like one of these plans to service your boiler. Like, you know, you make a subscription to keep the fundamental infrastructure of your business. There isn't a person listening to this podcast who doesn't use REST Framework, right?
Mm.
So, you know, if all those people fund it a little bit, if all those companies fund it a little bit, then it's totally sustainable on the ongoing basis.
Yeah.
I think too, it's easier for people to understand that DRF is you and a small team. Whereas, I mean, I'm constantly struck by Django as just this amorphous thing, even though it is a half dozen people who really do the yeoman's work. It's a little bit easier in a way when people can see, oh, it's going to Tom and his crew, right? It's not, I don't know, it's a little bit even easier ask, because I think of this in the context of I'm constantly thinking for the Django Software Foundation. I think there's a lot of ways they could get more money, which would help a lot of things. But it's a little bit harder than when you're literally on stage saying, you know, I want to work for you for $100 a month. And it's just like, man, if I'm using DRF for anything as a business, that's obviously a total no-brainer. So
I think it's really important that there's a very direct link between sponsorships and the person doing the work, because I think it is a personal relationship. I mean, you know, I think there's probably more that we could be doing in that space as well. That, you know, so for instance, things that I've kind of toyed with recently is, well, it would be great to get somebody else in with a bit of funded time on the project. Well, maybe the right sort of way to approach that is you have a mentorship program, and you specifically ask for, you know, we want to run this program and we need three companies to sponsor it.
Yeah.
And here's how much we expect you to pay. And then it's a very direct relationship. You know, they can say, we're sponsoring this program.
Right.
You know, that person.
I think that is what they want at a corporate level. They want to, I mean, it's like giving to, you know, university, you want your name in the building versus just general fund, right? Everyone wants to point to their specific thing. I mean, because I think, again, in the Django context, I would posit that 95-99% of people have no idea that a Django fellow exists, let alone that there are two, let alone that Carlton is one of them. I mean, it's just totally, the DSF, I nobody knows what that is because they don't really have to. So it's I like your idea of direct relationship for mentee. I mean, well, just this year, the DSF with Jacob Kaplan Moss is mentoring someone on, I think, what, adding something to the funding page. They got 1,000 people,
right?
You know, who wanted to be mentored. And I think if you had a company that would sponsor that or something, Yeah, that's brilliant. That makes a lot of sense. Mm. It's like a badge that a company can talk about and, yeah, have, a, as you said, a direct relationship between their funding and what they're getting out of it.
Well, it's a lot easier for me and REST Framework to be able to tackle that sort of thing because I can just be very unilateral in how I want to approach funding, right? Whereas that's more difficult with a something where there's a bunch of different people who are all kind of equally responsible for the health of the project, to go to make very like direct decisions about, you know what, let's put the funding up front and center and let's be very direct about this. You know what? Those conversations can be more complicated.
Yeah. Django's a big ship. It takes a while to turn, you know?
Yeah, but if you go to a DjangoCon in the US or Europe or now Africa next year, I mean, it's still a small number of people who really make it happen, which, I mean, this is like, being by far the newest to this community of the three of us, I keep getting struck by, first, it's like, wow, this is amorphous thing. And then I'm like, oh my God, it's so fragile. Like, I mean, Carlton's given some talks to this point.
Django isn't, you know, this big organization. There's Marius, there's myself, there's half a dozen people who are very active. And then there's, you know, 50 people who are kind of active. And then that's it. That's it. And, you know, people will email the Django developers saying, the Django team. And it's like, well, really, that's you if you step up.
Well, it's true in so many places as well, right? There's a lot of places where there's these core bits of, you go in Python or any other bit of the space where something absolutely critical and it's one person.
Yeah.
Sitting in their garage, you know, every now and again, who's working on it out of love.
Yeah.
Well,
open source.
As we wrap up, is there anything else you want to mention, highlight? I mean, there will be a couple thousand people listening to this and, you know, it'll be there for posterity.
No, just hi.
Super. Okay,
no,
well,
but, come back in 6 months' time and I might have something different to say to that question. So we'll see.
Okay. Okay.
Great. Well, and we're going to have links to all the stuff, encode everything in the show notes. So please do check out all the packages and stacks that are being worked on.
I'm hoping to go to PyCon in 2020, which is not something
in
I
Pittsburgh.
Do very often. Yeah, I'm not often, over in the States. So it would be really wonderful to chat with loads and loads and loads of people there because I'm not over that way much. So,
but you'll be at DjangoCon Europe. They've publicly announced it's in Porto, Portugal. Are you going to be there?
I haven't figured that out yet.
Okay, sorry to put you on the spot. I think I'm going to try to cross over the pond for the first time.
Right.
I'm really excited to.
Yes,
see Carlos.
No, I've been in a bit of a squish at the moment. So
okay, we can cut that bit out. I'll
pretty
just...
much down.
Okay, so Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show, and listen, from us and from the whole Django community and beyond, thank you so much for all the contributions you give and all the work you've done. You're just, you know, superhero.
Oh, cool.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Yes, thank you, Tom.
And this was Django Chat. Join us next time, folks.